So the topic of today is which political party does God vote for? Is God a liberal? Does he belong to the Labour Party?
Probably
the Greens. and really that is the Jewish view on politics. So they tell the story about a thief who sticks a pistol in a man's ribs and he says, "Give me your money." And the gentleman, who is obviously shocked by the sudden attack, says to the man, "You cannot do this, I'm a politician." So the thief says, "In that case, give me my money." So the first stop in deciding which political ideology is the closest aligned to what Judaism, Torah would advocate, I think the first step is we need to define political ideologies. Reminder of the story of this wagon driver, and just to put this in context, a modern context that we could relate to, just like a cab driver, a cabbie today is somebody who has definite opinions on every subject, and if they were running the world, we'd be in a far better shape. Well, the wagon drivers in Europe had similar personalities. And these wagon drivers would carry passengers to and fro their destinations, and they were discussing all sorts of things. Now, in Europe at the time was a very dynamic time in terms of politics. Political isms were expanding, and there was communism, socialism, capitalism, and they were vying for the hearts and minds of the population of the earth, right? I mean, everywhere in the world there were wars being fought over it, and so people were having discussions, and they were discussing the right and the left. They were talking about which political system is the best. And they were going right, left, and some passengers felt that those on the right were the best, and some passengers felt that those political systems on the left brought the most benefit to the citizens. And so they were arguing. Finally they turned to the wagon driver, who's a clever guy. They want his opinion. And they say, "What do you think, left or right?" So he points out on the road, shouldn't have told this story while you're still eating, I should have waited. Anyway, so please excuse me. He points out on the road that there's a big pile of horse dung, manure, horse doo-doo. And a wagon wheel had gone through the pile of manure and had split it into two, a left and a right. So the wagon driver tells his passengers, "You see over there," he points out the pile, and he says, "There's a left and there's a right." And he says in Yiddish, "Abes is the zelbe," I don't want to say the word, he says the same stuff. Let's put it that way. The same...
Rubbish,
thank you. It's the same rubbish, left and right. That was his opinion on politics. So one could definitely take that view, but I hope to take a slightly nuanced view and at least to come up with a better definition of what exactly is left and right, so that once we have that definition, we can match it against the Torah's ideal of how we should function as a society, and then we can see, is left close, is right close, and at least we have a starting point. Another thing, many religious groups in the world are actively involved in forming governments, in advocating the change, governmental change, policy change, etc. So one thinks of the churches in the United States that are very politically active. They have well-defined agendas, they have many, many adherents, and they use that political clout to influence politics. There was a famous Catholic priest, O'Connor, who in 1984 there was a presidential election, and he made a proclamation that all Catholics in the United States are forbidden, prohibited, to vote for a politician that supports abortion, because the Catholic Church is against abortion in any way, shape, or form, and they felt that it would be wrong to support any political candidate that was pro-choice. So, and you know, he made a prohibition. So any Catholic that voted for such a politician would immediately be excommunicated. So the question is, should rabbis also become politically active and use their influence within their communities to pick and choose candidates and advise their communities which candidates to do? So my personal feeling is that as a rabbi, we should, in most cases, with some notable exceptions, remain politically neutral. And the reason is because the function of a rabbi, the very name rabbi, means to be a teacher. A rabbi is a spiritual guide. And the main function of a rabbi is to draw his congregation, his flock, if you will, closer to an appreciation of spirituality, of godliness, etc. And if a rabbi, and you know, I don't know if you've noticed, here in Australia, they have a sport called footy. I don't know if anybody's aware of that. And you may have noticed also that people are very passionate about their football teams. Now, I have been here in Australia for about 8 months, and I still have not chosen a football team. Not that I'm a procrastinator, but I am very, very afraid that the minute... How many footy teams are there in total? 12?
I wouldn't have a clue. 16?
I don't know.
16?
I'm from Sydney.
16 footy teams in total. If I would... choose one team, I would instantly alienate 15/16 of my congregation. I would become a hero amongst 1/16 of it, but more or less, you're going to make a lot of enemies. If you get involved in politics, you're going to, obviously people feel very strongly, that's human psychology. We choose a group, we choose a team, and we back our team. So if we're Republican or Democrat, if we're Liberal or Labour, if we're Green or Independent, these things, we get very invested in these things, and emotionally invested and intellectually invested. And that's why, you know, you should never speak about politics or religion or any subject like that. That's going to be controversial, because you're going to alienate the people who are not of the same political opinion as you, and you're therefore going to be less effective and less influential. That is my personal opinion. Many of my colleagues would disagree with it, and I can see their points of view as well. That being a rabbi is a teacher and a guide in all aspects of life, they would maintain. But again, I am not necessarily of that view. And then finally, if we have some time, I want to discuss a very interesting halachic, from a perspective of Jewish law, if we would even be permitted to vote for certain candidates, similar to the Catholic example that I just gave. All right, so let's start with a train journey. And on that train, there's a whole bunch of Jews, and they're having a discussion about which political ideology is the best and most beneficial, similar to the wagon. And they turn to the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who happened to be on the train as well, and was in the room, although he was studying or learning, he was in the room, in the compartment on the train, where this discussion was taking place. And the previous Rebbe, they turn to him and they say, "No, what do you think? Communism? Socialism, capitalism, what do you think is the best political system, the best ism?" And the previous Rebbe said that they all have good points and they all have drawbacks. Their good points are all to be found in the Torah's philosophy and the Torah's attitude on how one should conduct a society, and their bad points are all against the philosophy of Judaism. Now, obviously, you would expect a rabbi to say such a thing. I don't think that shocks anybody here, that he felt that all the best features of every political system find reflection in Judaism, in Jewish teachings, and the problems with each system are not taken care of. But it's very interesting. So let's go into a definition, my definition, my personal definition of the left and the right. I'm going to call it left and right, although every definition changes. For example, I come from Canada, and in Canada, the Liberal Party is very strongly ideologically aligned with what we would call the Labour Party here. And our Liberal Party in Canada, we call them the Conservatives. So obviously these names change. Even Republicans and Democrats have shifted. So I'm just going to say left and right, just as a matter of convenience. I don't know. There were some parliamentary systems where people who espouse philosophies I'm going to discuss soon sat on the right side of parliament and their opponents sat on the left. And there are some cases where that was switched. So what exactly does left mean? What does right mean? Well, I'm going to give a working definition for this discussion, and then you can apply it to every country, to every place. But I have certainly seen that this has been I've lived in South Africa, I've lived in Canada, I've lived in Israel, and now I'm living in Australia. And I can tell you that this definition has always served me perfectly. It has never broken down. You can always divide any political ideology into this, what I'm calling for now, left and right, based on the definition I'm about to give. So it's a very useful definition. So a lot of times right, the people of the right wing are called conservatives. What does the word conservative mean? Don't all speak at once. Mm-hmm.
Do you like things the way they are?
Yes, it comes from the word conserve. Yeah. You are conserving something. So what does it mean you're conserving something? What exactly are you conserving?
The tradition. Preserving the tradition.
Okay. You're right. Many people would give that definition of conservative or right wing. You're conserving a tradition. But I feel that that's a very dangerous definition. Because let's say you were an Aztec. Now the Aztecs believed in human sacrifice. They believed that to appease the gods, to make the rains fall, or in our case probably stop falling, you just needed to take some maidens and sacrifice them, burn them alive, and that will appease the gods. Now that was an old and ancient tradition that was around for many centuries. So would you say that the definition of a conservative Aztec is somebody who wants to keep human sacrifice alive?
So to speak.
Well, I hope not, for conservatives all over the world's sake, for right-wing political parties all over the world. Because just to conserve something because it's always been there is a very weak foundation on which to preserve something. You want to preserve something only if it has value. If not, not. So I think
we are preserving our Torah, aren't we?
We preserve our Torah, absolutely, because we believe that our Torah is very valuable, very precious, and it's something worth conserving. That doesn't make us conservatives or right wing.
The conservative movement doesn't really keep the Torah.
Right, the conservative movement is liberal. It's very confusing. Okay, so exactly.
They're more concerned with conserving the moral compass or how they perceive the country should be.
Correct.
Not necessarily the actual physical traditions of sacrifice or whatever it is.
Valid point. So the point that Simon made is that conservatives have an ideal view of how the world should be, and it's that they're trying to preserve and conserve. I don't accept that entirely. My definition is as follows. They're conserving the natural experiential order of things. They're conserving human experience. They're conserving the natural order of how things are based in reality and experience. That's what they're conserving. Let me explain what a left-wing party is, to be able to understand that. And then you'll see how I can apply this universally across the board to almost any policy that any government creates. And have the added advantage that you will never be surprised again by a Labour government coming up with a carbon tax, or the Greens proposing euthanasia. None of these things are going to surprise you once you filter through this definition. So let's look at the definition. Number one. So let's look at the left wings for a moment. The leftists, they are the ones, by my definition, that have a perfect notion, a utopian notion, of how the world should be. And it's entirely academic, that notion. It comes from theory, the world of theory, the world of thought, the world of philosophy. It is, in most cases, beautiful, wonderful. It includes brotherhood, it includes justice and fairness, and it can include prosperity for all, equality for all. It's a marvelous view, a utopian view of what the world should be like. It's not necessarily a tested view. It's not been tested in reality, but it, on paper, it looks beautiful. Then, left-wing philosophy, ideology, believes that the government is the only body that is able to implement that utopian view of how society should be. In other words, individuals are not capable of bringing society to that utopian view, and therefore the government needs to take over control of society as much as possible in order for this magnificent goal of making society reach this beautiful utopian state. Okay, so that's the left. So let's look at an extreme. Always the extreme illustrates the point in the most dramatic fashion. So let's look at communism. Fantastic philosophy. I mean, on paper it looks beautiful. Equality, justice, everybody working for a common good. How can you go wrong? I mean, that is a beautiful utopian state. If we could accomplish that and achieve that, wow, how beautiful is that? So 50 million people, that's 50 million people are killed by Stalin to try and implement and impose this beautiful view that's so egalitarian and cares so much about the individual that they brutally murder and torture 50 million people in order to try and implement this thing. And it fails in the end. It's not sustainable. Why does it fail? Because it forgot to take into consideration the reality, the experiential reality of human greed, for example, and the things that truly motivate us to accomplish things. Okay, so this is the problem of communism. Communism got stuck. And that is most leftist agendas follow that exact pattern. It's a beautiful concept, you know, broadband internet for all. How can you go wrong with that? That is so beautiful that some guy sitting out in rural, who knows where,
Ackersburg,
wherever, can surf the net at speeds that would be the envy of us, living here in Melbourne. Beautiful concept. So how much is it going to cost? Who's going to do it? Well, a leftist government would say it's going to cost 40 billion, which may be even more closer to 80 billion, and before they even lay down the first fiber optic cable, the whole technology is obsolete. Nobody's using that technology. We've moved on to wireless technologies, superior technologies, and it will never be a success, even though it sounds so magnificent on paper. All right, let me offend the right wingers now a little bit in the audience. So people on the right, they believe in what experience shows to be true. And experience shows a few things to be true. Number one, that for a society to truly be successful as a society, there's a fundamental building block that needs to be strong, healthy, and good. And that is a two-parent nuclear family. Mother, father, and children. And that has to be preserved at all cost. That unit, called the family, has to be given the most autonomy that it can. The most freedom to raise their children, the next generation, in a way that is most beneficial to the selfish needs of the family. And then many families make up a village, and many villages make up a city. And when I say city, I'm not talking about a vast sprawling metropolis, I'm talking about a modest-sized city, big enough to support things like the arts, social welfare programs, education, medical requirements of the population, but not bigger than that. Bigger than that, the reality, history has shown, anything that gets bigger than that, if you try, it becomes unwieldy, it becomes decentralized, and it becomes detached from a moral compass, a moral value. So a federal government, by definition, is not right-wing, is not conservative. Because the whole notion of a federal government, you might need, a conservative might concede that you need a federal government to run an army, to protect the sovereignty of the nation. But that's it. The federal government should not be involved in anything else in a purely right-wing political ideology. Not involved in collecting any taxes beyond what they need to run the army. Not involved in setting any policies, social or otherwise, because they are too detached to the reality, the core reality, which is the family. The family is where morality is taught. The family level is where people become self, self-regulating. People become are taught to be self-regulating at the family level. I was just recently reminded of probably one of the most famous psychological experiments ever done. They call it the marshmallow experiment. Basically what they did is this guy at Stanford, his name's Dr. Michel, he got a whole bunch of kids to into a room, and he put a marshmallow down in front of them, one marshmallow. Actually, it was Oreo cookies, but I don't know how they call it, the marshmallow experiment. So he put a marshmallow, a cookie, in front of the kids, and he said to them, listen, guys, if you don't touch that cookie, I'm going to come back in 10 minutes' time with two cookies. You're going to double up, right? But if you eat that cookie, that's it. You're only getting one. And, he filmed them to see, and there were all sorts of very funny things. You can YouTube the videos. They're hilarious. One of the kids took the Oreo cookie, and he ate the inside of the cookie out, and then he put it back together to make it look like it wasn't eaten. And, some kids walked around, looked away, some kids ate it, all different reactions, probably the whole spectrum of human reaction there. And then they followed these children up for about 30 years following the experiment. And they saw an interesting thing. Those children who had the strength, the discipline, self-discipline, not to participate, not to eat, were much more likely to finish tertiary education, get a degree at university. They were much more likely to remain married, not get divorced. They were much more likely to be successful financially as they became adults. They were much less likely to commit suicide than the children who didn't have that self-control. The other interesting part of the experiment was that they asked the kids that did have the self-control, where did it come from? And most of those kids learned that skill of delayed gratification in their homes. That's where it came from. you know, it's, you know, mommy and daddy taught me to do this trick. One kid speaks about, I pretended it was, my mommy told me to pretend when I want something very bad and I can't have it, to pretend that it's a picture of the thing, not the thing itself. You know, all these strategies. Because, you know, I'm a parent, and education happens in all those moments where you least expect it to happen, where a child does something and you jump in and you're right there. No government in the world could ever be a better nanny than a parent. And so, at least according to the right ideology, and therefore people on the right wing will support the family and the autonomy of the family to make their own decisions as much as possible and decentralize authority and power as much as possible. Once you have that definition that I've just given you, so the definition of a left, to summarize, of a left wing ideology would be a perfect utopian vision and giving the government all the powers that it needs to bring that vision to fruition. That would be the definition of any leftist agenda. A rightist agenda would be giving the decentralizing power as much as possible from the central authorities, putting power into the hands of the smallest units more and more, and making sure that morality features into that, conserving that morality as well. So that is the definition. Once you have that definition, you can throw any government at me, any political decision they made, and you can then slot them in to one of those two positions. So let's look at Robert Menzies. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Yeah,
Menzies. Okay. See, in French, would have dropped the S.
That's right.
Robert Menzies. Sorry about that. So apparently, he was the founder of the Liberal Party here in Australia. And in 1964, I found this quote from him. He was Prime Minister of Australia at the time. And that was his last address to the Liberal Party Federal Council in 1964. And Robert Menzies spoke of what he called the liberal creed, and I'm going to quote it. He said this follows: as the etymology of our name liberal indicates, we have stood for freedom. We have realized that men and women are not just ciphers in a calculation, but are individual human beings whose individual welfare and development must be the main concern of government. You see, it's individualist. It's the main concern is free up people, free them from bureaucracy, free them from laws that hinder them. Just parenthetically, I heard there was a study they just published last week that the amount of laws that are in the Gazette of any country is inversely proportionate to the amount of corruption in every country, which means the more laws a country has on its books, the more corrupt that country will be. And the less laws, the less corrupt a country is. So you want to take away all the laws as much as possible so that people can self-govern and self-regulate and put the emphasis on the family. Liberal means to free them. So he continues, Robert Menzies, we have learned that the right answer is to set the individual free, to aim at equality of opportunity, to protect the individual against oppression, to create a society in which rights and duties are recognized and made effective. See how that fits perfectly into my definition of what a right-wing government would be. The next quote is from the former Labour leader Kevin Rudd's first speech to Parliament, 1998. So look what he says. Competitive markets are massive and generally efficient generators of economic wealth. They must therefore have a central place in the management of the economy. So that's kind of a right-wing thing. But then he says, but markets sometimes fail. They're not perfect, requiring direct government intervention through instruments such as industry policy. In other words, when you little children fail, big, clever, brilliant government will jump on in. By the way, the same government, parenthetically, that's about to spend $200 per pensioner in Australia to provide them with the inalienable right to watch television because they are stopping to have analog television sets are no longer going to work at a certain point. So the Labor government has decided that at a cost of around $200 per pensioner, they're going to install a box into the television to make sure that they can receive a digital signal.
$200.
Now, if you go
to... Not only that, but the contractors have not been doing it correctly.
Oh, really?
And I could possibly do this if I was so inclined for about $20 retail. You know, if I could go retail and not buy bulk, you could do it for about $20. You could get one of these boxes and plug them in. So obviously, you know, but government knows better. When industry and private capitalism fails, we will step in, says Mr. Rudd.
When did it happen, this $200?
It's right now. It's in the federal budget. There are also areas where the public good dictates that there should be no market at all. That's very ominous. That's what he says. There are also areas where the public good, that utopian vision, dictates that there should be no market at all. In other words, we've got to control everything. So every decision that they make, from carbon tax to... What's carbon tax? Carbon tax is you're too stupid as an individual, as a family, to manage your energy use consumption. We're much more intelligent at this. We're going to penalize you with... You know, government's fine and they have laws and they have punitive measures to make sure those laws go into effect.
There are some areas where they're naturally... have to be monopolies, like train tracks. You know, you can't have everyone, private companies, laying their own train tracks. You need a government to do it, otherwise you'll get different gauges and problems that we had when you had New South Wales and Victoria with different gauges and no one would change it.
Really? There's something called the internet, which has a set of standards that were not government imposed. They were imposed by consensus and the internet...
Throughout.
The standards?
Yeah.
HTTPS was ARPANET? No, it was
that was way later.
The very first standards. Okay, how successful were they compared to what the internet is? That's my point. Government could do things, but it will always cost more.
Sure, but I think the point that Kevin Rudd was trying to make is that it's been conclusively proven that without regulation, corporations don't act in the public interest. They act in their shareholders' interest, and that leads to massive amounts of environmental damage and, you know, oil spills in countries that nobody cares about.
Which creates opportunity
for cleanup.
For cleanup.
That's right.
For fixing.
That's terrible.
In other words, if you let...
That's like saying we should break the window so the window maker doesn't go out of business.
They would destroy
the planet
if somebody would pay you to break windows and then pay somebody else to fix windows. I think that sounds like a good economy.
It's not a zero-sum game. It's not my window breaking is a loss for me and a gain for the window maker. Windows aren't a finite resource.
It is over the big... Keynes called the invisible hand. Ultimately, there's like an invisible hand that's self-correcting. In perfect capitalist state, I can give you hundreds of examples.
Will happen if all I'm doing around is breaking windows.
I'll give you hundreds of examples. There's a slogan in the United States that we heard a lot last year, and that was too big to fail.
Yes.
2 years ago. And that slogan means that there were companies, you see, it's a self-correcting system, capitalism. And companies...
But the correction may be a massive recession.
It may be, but it would be massive, intense, and over. What we've done by intervening... Here I'm giving my own opinion, which I was trying not to do. What we've done by intervening is prolonged... You know, there's a fantastic study out of Harvard about the global recession in the 30s. The fact that the New Deal, with Roosevelt's New Deal came in and, you know, he tried to do very similar things that Bush and Obama tried to do, which is prop up certain industries and pick certain banks to fail and certain not to fail and public works and so on. So now with the advantage of hindsight, the economists at Harvard have said that the recession was prolonged by 15 years because of the government intervention. In other words, their computer models show that had the government not intervened, and it will be the same today, had the government not intervened in General Motors, in Chrysler, in some banks that they chose to intervene, these things would have collapsed.
Absolutely.
Millions of people would have lost their jobs. But you know what? The opportunity that would have grown would have meant that our children and maybe even grandchildren would still be riding the boom that would come from that. Because ultimately, what really grows things is individuals tinkering in their garages and coming up with Apple computers.
Sure.
That's what innovation is, what is driving the modern knowledge economy.
I don't think he was talking about the end of the cycle. I think he was talking about the growth of the cycle. So when you have massive companies like BP or AT&T or whoever you want to pick as you know, huge conglomeration of the week, if you look at Telstra here or Financial Instruments or whatever it could be, without regulation as they're growing, they're going to do more damage to other people as an externality.
Yeah.
Like in the power industry, you know, coal is great for Australia. We sell shitloads of it, so and it's easy to build.
You're obviously passionate. That's good.
We understand the technology, but as an externality, the planet is bogus. Like, you know, it's, I don't know if everybody here believes in climate change, but I think the evidence is pretty undeniable, and it's not good for anybody else except for the people who are invested in it.
Yeah.
So while it's great for them and you know, notion of freedom and do whatever you want as long as it makes you money and makes you happy, without the regulation, I'm not saying it has to be a lot, just enough so that other people's interests are protected.
But the problem is that governments consistently
they're not very good at it.
Are not
that.
Good at it.
But there has
so
to be
there's two things. You could leave it to absolute randomness, to chaos, yes. Which is also not perfect.
Well, that's titanic.
It's not chaos. It's capitalism. Which
capitalism.
Is
okay. Leave it to capitalism.
On
leave it to the
growth.
Leave it to the invisible hand of capitalism. Is one alternative. Is option A. Option B is let governments decide. So, you know, I can give you many historical examples. There was a law. There is a law in the United States. What's it called? I forget the name. The two senators who installed the law, but. The law is it's an anti oligarch law, an
antitrust
law, yeah. Anti-monopoly law, and you know they were very, you know, in the 50s when they implemented this, they were very excited because now they're going to break certain monopolies and it's going to create
Bell
opportunities. Which
Bell.
Ones?
Bell,
yeah. So and this became the accepted wisdom in the Western world today, is that you know all monopolies are bad and it's highly legal to have monopolies and price fixing and all of that stuff. Okay, but Drucker says a very interesting thing in one of his books where he discusses this. He says there was never a monopoly that existed for more than 10 years in history prior to the law forcing them to disband. Naturally they didn't exist because they got too big and systems don't work. That, the same conservative approach which says the family is a better way of raising a generation than the state or than the government, that same idea also applies to the companies. Companies get very big and then they fail. And in fact, the monopoly laws have kept these companies much larger than they perhaps would have been had they not been monopoly laws. And there are many, many, many examples of this that we can give that have somehow slipped through the cracks. But it applies to everything. 9/11, 2001, right? The day that will live on into infamy. There were four airplanes.
You know there were hardly anybody in the airplane. Are you aware of that?
Well, there were four airplanes.
Yes, but there were hardly any.
Well, I don't know if you fly ever in the United States, they're very small airplanes, these things, and they don't fit too many people in. But there were four airplanes that were hijacked on the day. Three of them hit their intended targets, unfortunately, and we all know the disastrous results of that. One of them did not. Okay? And there's, you know, a lot of, there was a movie made about it and a lot of discussion. So the three other ones, the three that hit their targets, as soon as they were hijacked, and it became apparent that they were hijacked, a government protocol developed in the 60s went into effect. Now, you should know that being in an airplane is the place on Earth where you have the least rights of any place on, well, not on Earth, I guess, but you have less rights than anywhere else, you know, save maybe for a prison. Even there, you could smoke in prison, so.
And use your mobile phone if you have one.
And use your mobile phone, exactly. So you walk in, and it is a perfect leftist environment. Power is given to the stewards, air stewards. They are, you know, the absolute, you know, even mobile phones, that's a perfect example. So I've spoken to a lot of scientists about this. There is no way that my little, you know, $40 mobile phone is going to bring down a multi-million dollar airplane or interfere in any way with the operation and running of that airplane. And that is a total falsehood. To prove that, in Europe now you're allowed to use your mobile phones.
There's more to do with the towers on the ground, and interestingly enough.
Yeah, with the mobile phone towers, because yeah. If a plane, if like 60 people are on their phone, and boom, yeah, and it hits you, it could, yes, it could. That is true.
What's that?
If you're high up, you can see many, many more towers than you could if you're just standing on a city corner.
Right.
And so it tries to connect and query all of them, and so just pass it, you're on the phone and it has to pass a phone call from tower to tower, and you're in a plane. It could basically flood the entire network.
Entire network
if you're here's over here, over here, over here.
Yeah. That is true. So, but still, there are stewards. You try and use a mobile phone. All right.
Yeah, we know.
In a thing. Anyway, so I was going to quote something from the Greens as well. They advocate an increase in company tax rate in the last election.
Did you finish off anything about the 911?
No, I didn't. All right, I'll finish the 911 and that'll be it, and we'll continue this topic another time. So the 911, three of the four planes went into this perfect, they followed this protocol perfectly, which was developed by the government, implemented by their stewards, their policemen who are the stewards.
They assume they wanted to negotiate.
Yes, that's what the protocols are based on. They weren't expecting this crazy mentality where the hijackers would destroy themselves, their own lives. And of course, it was very bad. In Flight 147, which was the one that crashed into the in Pennsylvania into the ground, the stewards also told people to sit quietly. Some of the passengers said, "Let's rush the cockpit and the stewards were, "No, you're not allowed to do that." And then they decided, "Look, we've got to take things into our own hands." It's true they were getting cell phone calls, they were getting phone calls from relatives and that explaining, what had allegedly happened with the other three planes. So they did have a little bit more insight than others. Than the others, but nonetheless, it was a group of three or four men who took matters into their own hands. Again, removing it from the nanny state, bringing it down into the individual state, and they almost successfully averted all tragedy. Unfortunately, when the hijackers realized what was going on, that they weren't following the protocols that they should, the hijackers crashed the plane purposely into the ground, killing all those brave and courageous people. Unfortunately, but any case you want to choose,
it has a left and a right. That as well, but it doesn't
there is.
Matter for the point.
Okay, this I would say this is officially draws to an end for today's. But I'll be happy to stay behind if some people want to attack me.